everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition
of the Corwin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in company's profile.
Now, the Corwin Economics Report. We are commentating on the markets and also talking to a number of company executives to get really up to date on what the company is doing, mostly focused in the resource sector. We are kicking off this weekend show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. And Jesse, look, you post quite a few blog posts for your subscribers talking a lot of big picture concepts when it comes to Fed policy, market sentiment, and global issues. We'll break down a couple of the key factors, mostly focused on markets and where investors are positioning themselves. Let's first just quickly touch on Fed policy, because right now we know a fair bit about what the Fed is thinking in terms of rate hikes and when those will start, which the expectation is for next month. We don't know if it'll be a 25 basis point hike, 50 basis point hike. Either way, the process of hiking rates is starting. But there's a few things that we really don't know about Fed policy, and that is potential balance sheet unwind. Or one thing we are discussing off mic is potential yield curve control. This is a concept that's been, in a way, almost forgotten, although we were talking about it a couple years ago. Jesse, give us your thoughts broadly on what the Fed is going to do here and what's important for investors to watch as they undoubtedly announce new policies and potentially change some of their guidance.
I think maybe one of the important, most important points people need to understand is that the Fed has been outright monetizing the U.S. federal debt for at least a decade now. After they started QE2, Ben Bernanke was accused, when testifying in front of Congress. This was almost 11 years ago, exactly to the week. He was accused of monetizing the debt. That's what the purpose of QE is for. He said, no, look. We are not monetizing the debt. What monetizing the debt looks like is a permanent increase in the money supply in order to help fund the government's needs. What we're doing is temporary. The balance sheet's going to $2-3 trillion maybe, but we're going to normalize. We're going to bring it back down to $1 trillion here. And so these are just temporary operations to support the economy. Well, the Fed's balance sheet has gone from $2-2.5 trillion to almost $9 trillion. In the last 10 years. So this is a permanent increase in the money supply. We've seen a massive increase in the money supply, a permanent increase in the Fed's balance sheet. And especially over the last 2 years, I mean, the Fed has printed so much money. They've essentially funded 70% of the government's funding needs for the past 2 years. So this is, according to Ben Bernanke's definition, this is monetization of the debt, and I don't think there's any way the Fed can get out of this. They're trapped. They're now in what economists kind of refer to as fiscal dominance, where the Treasury's needs take precedence over anything else the central bank might want to accomplish, including a normalization of interest rates or monetary policy. So the Fed is going to try and normalize monetary policy, but every time they've tried to do that over the last 10 years, it's caused problems in the markets. And in reaction, the Fed has said, hey, okay, sorry, we're not going to normalize. We're going to go back to printing money because they're trapped into doing this. And so I think that is basically the pattern that they're in. And even, you know, former Fed officials have been warning about this for a long time. Tom Hoenig has been warning, you know, when he was a voting member on the FOMC, he dissented many times during these QE, periods. It was really the lone dissenting voice. But, you know, he's been coming out recently saying the Fed is trapped. They basically opened Pandora's box when they started QE, and the amount of debt that's been created basically makes it impossible for them to normalize. And so I do think we're going to hear talk about yield curve control at some point in the near future again as the economy slows and the Fed attempts to normalize. We've already seen mortgage rates go from 3-4% in just, you know, a couple of months' time. And that, you know, is could become really problematic for household balance sheets, and if it puts creates a slowdown or a bear market for real estate prices, And the Fed, you know, understands these risks. They understand the risk to the corporate credit markets. I think, you know, that's a lot of thing. Another thing people don't maybe appreciate enough is the Fed put is not based on the S&P 500. It's based on corporate credit spreads. Ben Bernanke, Jay Powell is a former private equity guy. He knows what corporate leverage looks like and how vulnerable it is. And so we're going to see a slowdown. We're going to see them normalize, and then we're going to hear talk about how the Fed is going to stay involved in the Treasury market. And they may not use the word permanent, but it's becoming more and more obvious that this is a permanent feature of the Treasury market.
Yeah, Jesse, they may not use the word permanent, but their emergency accommodation back in 2009 has gone on over a dozen years now, and they're just now finishing the tapering. Everybody's been talking about how tightening has been happening, but they really haven't tightened anything yet. All they've been doing is reducing the amount of purchases. And so you just mentioned that the goal of the Fed is to normalize the rates, but with the CPI reading of 7.5, with PPI readings over 9%, can they really normalize things? And even if they moved it up a percentage point or 2 percentage points, would that really tame inflation? And what can they really do to get on top of inflation without getting crushed by the debt load?
It's the $9 trillion question, right? That's the balance sheet. I think the only way the Fed is going to rein in inflation and break the inflationary psychology that's building right now in the economy is by creating a recession. You're going to have to tighten policy enough. And I don't know where that is. That might be 1% on the Fed funds rate, might be enough to crash the stock market, which would create a disinflationary impulse of its own and kind of put people in a different mindset than they're in right now. So I don't know where that is. But if they do allow the asset markets to reprice enough, then that can kind of break the inflationary psychology. I just don't think that they're willing or able to allow monetary policy to go that far to create a recession and to really, create the pain in the markets that is required to rein in inflation. They might get it whether they want it or not. They're playing with fire here. They've essentially created a situation where the markets are now, but Treasury market, stock market, corporate bond markets are completely dependent on Fed intervention. And now that they're removing it, it's essentially pulling the floor out from under these things. And, it's a very dangerous game.
So, Jesse, what about past tightening cycles from the Fed? Because the Fed has tried to tighten before, I believe, 11 of 14 monetary tightening cycles since 1955 were followed by increases in unemployment and, quite frankly, drops in markets and drops in sentiment. Are you comparing this tightening cycle to any of the other past ones in terms of what we can expect market-wise, sentiment-wise?
I think, yes, I'm comparing it. I think one of the things that is most interesting to me is some of these gaps between what the market is pricing in and what is likely to happen going forward. I think the only tightening period we could look back to are the last couple, when the Fed was tightening into 2018. Really, I mean, Jay Powell's tightening is really kind of the only one we can look back to. This is the only one in modern times when we'd had as much money printing as we have today, and markets that are so dependent upon the Fed. But to me, I think, Bridgewater put out a piece recently, and I thought it was fascinating that markets are now pricing in a benign outcome in terms of inflation, in terms of the economy and the stock market. And I think, the Fed is not going to be able to have its cake and eat it too. They're either going to be able to rein in inflation, and they're going to have to hurt the economy and the risk markets in the process, or they're going to protect the economy and the markets, and they're not going to be able to rein in inflation. And so, basically, I think as an investor, you're making bets on right now on what you think that outcome is going to be. But if markets are pricing in, inflation's going to come back down to normal, and the stock market and the economy are going to be okay, then there are opportunities to profit from that. And really, that was Bridgewater's point, is that, to the extent that that consensus is wrong, it yields opportunities for investors to kind of play those trades. And now I think, what are those? Well, you know, if that's what markets are pricing in, then probably the dollar's overvalued, gold's undervalued, stock market is potentially, vulnerable as well. And so, I think those are, the interesting things to look at right now in terms of what's going to happen over the next 6 months.
Well, Jesse, you put out a piece last weekend that highlighted that we are seeing the most negative forward guidance on earnings from companies at the same time as most of the stock market participants are still betting on record high margin growth. And there's a big disconnect there. I would love you to highlight that a little bit and unpack that for our audience.
Yeah, actually, I think it was, I can't remember, it was one of the big research houses that tracks analyst estimates, and analyst estimates are now discounting or essentially expecting the highest margins, profit margins in history. We already have the highest margins, but they're expected to actually expand to even fatter profit margins. And to me, that's astounding in light of the fact that company guidance, as you mentioned, Chad, has been, earnings guidance has been the most negative since 2009, since we were just coming out of the Great Recession. And so companies are telling, there's also an interesting, I think John Authors published, when you look at companies, just the words that company managements are using, when they talk about pricing power, that's usually a good leading indicator of margins. When they talk about more about labor costs, that's usually a good leading indicator of negative margins. And that's exactly what we've seen in the last few quarters, is companies went from talking about pricing power in the last several quarters to now, in the most recent quarter and the one just prior to it, they're talking more about labor costs than pricing power. Essentially, they're telling you our margins are going to come under pressure. And if profit margins come under pressure, then the PE on the S&P 500 is going to quickly look really expensive. It's why the price to sales ratio looks so dramatically overvalued today relative to the PE ratio, because profit margins are so fat that they make PE ratios look less dramatic than they are. But if profit margins are going to now normalize, then the price to sales ratio, as it usually does, will prove to be the more valuable valuation metric. And right now, we're still about 30% more expensive than we were at the peak of the dot-com mania in 2000 on price to sales ratios. So if margins are now going to contract, then you have a huge, repricing in the stock market that needs to happen.
Jesse, does this all tie into general liquidity, though? Because kind of circling around to the first topic is that, look, there is a lot more money in the system now, even with the Fed potentially starting to tighten. And so that money does end up in the market. So what is a reasonable valuation now when, quite frankly, there is just more capital available?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. I don't know how to adjust valuations for, based on the money supply. I will tell you that there's a really good relationship between M2 growth year over year and the stock market year over year. And M2 growth has been decelerating quickly and is going to continue to do so if the Fed is able to taper and eventually shrink the balance sheet. And I think that's what most people are worried about right now. This is what the Fed is most worried about, is the Fed really doesn't know. They've guessed, and none of us really know what the effects of quantitative easing have been in the markets and in the real economy. We can guess and point to things that, all this money printing has supported asset prices and things. I think the most obvious thing is that money printing that we've seen over the past 10 years has supported animal spirits in the markets. This is a concept I think we've talked about before, and it's as old as central banking. The central bankers know that when they print money, they can get people excited about speculating. And this has been a relationship between central banks and investors for centuries, honestly. And so when you end that money printing, you risk killing the animal spirits behind a lot of these things. And I think this is another just gap that I'd point to, is we see dramatically deteriorating consumer sentiment over the past couple of years. So as The stock market has soared higher. Consumer sentiment has gotten really negative. And normally these things go together. This is why the Fed has tried so hard to create a wealth effect, because they know we push the stock market up normally, that makes people feel better about the economy. They go spend more. Well, that hasn't been the case during this latest boom in the stock market. And there's only been, you know, when you look at, I think I first saw this chart from Bianco Research, this terrific chart. You take the 3-year correlation between the stock market and University of Michigan consumer sentiment, and normally they're really highly positively correlated, 50 to 90%, you know, stock market goes up, sentiment goes up. What we've seen in the past 2 years is something dramatically different, where sentiment has plunged while the stock market has moved higher. The only times we've seen this correlation become so negative was in 2007, right, when the real estate market was starting to roll over hard. Consumers starting to worry about their personal finances and the economy, and the stock market was soaring to new highs in the summer, fall of 2007, right before the financial crisis really kicked off. And again, we saw it in late 86, early 1987, when people started becoming worried about inflation again, and the Fed was going to tighten, and really kind of some of the catalysts of the 1987 stock market crash. But this deterioration in sentiment, I mean, consumers today are worried about their personal finances. They're worried about their ability to keep up with, you know, inflation in terms of their purchasing power. And I worry that it could be a harbinger of deteriorating risk appetite. This, I guess, the death of animal spirits in the stock market. It's really worrisome to me.
Well, yeah, Jesse, we've definitely already seen a lot of the death of animal spirits with the meme stocks capitulating, with some of the tech and growth stocks capitulating, with cryptos having a little bit of a pullback. And we've seen even things like the NASDAQ, where 40% of the NASDAQ stocks are down over 50% year over year. So are off their all-time highs, I should say. So we're already seeing the death of animal spirits. So I guess the question is, with all these macro factors, with the Fed getting ready to hike and try to normalize, with the potential of causing a recession, and all of these pressures building up, do you think that gold will start getting a safe haven bid as a risk-off asset with all of these different currents swirling around?
I think it already is. I think that's exactly why gold is going up lately. A lot of people have been stunned that, you know, supposedly gold and real interest rates have gone, you know, in opposite directions. There was an interesting piece in the Financial Times that was just about this topic. And when you look at gold and tips, they've had a very close relationship, performed very similar typically. But last year, or, you know, the last 18 months or something, we saw tips really soar strongly higher to new highs, and gold went into a correction. So they really diverged, and now, you know, tips have been getting hammered, and gold has been doing really well. So people are, you know, kind of stunned. Wait, what is going on? Why are they so off? Well, I think the thing that I've kind of just thought about is that, you know, the tips market has been massively manipulated through QE over the past 18 months, 2 years. The Fed, you know, came in and bought more tips as a, you know, percent of bonds outstanding than any other, you know, securities they were buying. And so they became, you know, you can't really trust the price signals in the tips market. So how do you explain, if it's not real interest rates, you know, driving, you know, the gold price, what is it? Well, there's a great quote in this FT article. I think people are starting to look more towards protection against dollar devaluation and wealth preservation and those other aspects of gold. And that is kind of why, I put out that blog post today, that people need to understand the Fed is monetizing the debt. They're trapped into doing this by fiscal dominance. The Treasury's needs are now greater than anything else the Fed may want to do. And in that scenario, you need to protect your purchasing power. Gold is the most obvious way to do that. And so I think investors are just beginning to appreciate this, which is why gold is starting to catch a bid again.
Jesse, isn't that true in other countries too? The monetizing of debt by central banks? It seems like other central banks are also stuck in this trap.
They are, but I mean, I think a lot of them, you know, you look at the European nations and they have, more constraints on what governments are allowed to do, right? And they essentially follow the Fed's lead, right? I mean, you look at the European Central Bank and they're not doing anything that the Fed is not going to do first. And so, Yeah, it is true. But I think it's, you know, to me, it's most important to see it being done in the Treasury market, because it's the market where I can look and see the Fed is stepping away from tapering and interest rates are going up. Normally, what I would expect, if this was just quantitative easing, tapering would lead to a slowdown in the economy. That would be make for lower interest rates. The fact that rates are going up as the Fed is tightening tells me that the Treasury market has been falsely supported by the Fed for the past several years, and it can't function without Fed intervention anymore. And to me, that is a very, very important signal that the Fed is going to be forced to maintain this type of position.
All right, Jesse, we're going to wrap it up here. I think no one's denying that the Fed is going to have to switch course again to some sort of easier monetary policy, and they haven't even started hiking rates yet. We just don't know when that's going to happen, but boy, oh boy, it has been interesting to see, again, inflation continue to stay high, markets show a little bit of weakness early on this year. Gold's gotten a little bit of a perk, but again, that's been pretty flat. It's been quite the dichotomy in terms of market moves and where investor sentiment is. But yeah, very interesting. Always hearing what you're writing about, what you're seeing out there. I look forward to having you back on the show, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. In the next two segments, we're going to be shifting our focus a little more specifically on the markets and some of the recent moves we have seen. We are chatting right now in this segment with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. You can also follow Dana's work over at the Lyons Share website. I will post a link to that website. And Dana, we talk a wide range of markets because, look, I love having you on the show because you do not carry any bias into these markets. You're simply using your internal models to show you where the best opportunities are in different sectors. And I want to start off with the precious metals sector, because gold has gotten a very nice buy, especially over the last couple weeks. And as we're recording this on Thursday, gold is sitting pretty much right at that $1,900 level. This is not just key psychological resistance, but also correlates with some other technical factors that we do need to pay attention to. But again, a lot of these moves higher are being predicated on these war fears out of Russia and Ukraine. We've talked a lot about that this past week on Daily Editorials. But rotating back to you following your models and trying to ignore some of these noise when it comes to different headlines, how are you viewing the gold space in this run to 1900?
Yeah, thanks, Corey. Just to touch on the news headlines right off the bat, there's a difference between news events and market impacting news or developments and news headlines. So whatever the underlying developments, events of the day that move markets, that all feeds into the data, the market data that we look at, and whether it's prices, breadth, you know, money flows, that type of thing. It all impacts that. So if you just pay attention to the data, you're better off than paying attention to the news events and the headlines of the day, because eventually it all feeds into there anyways. And if the event is market moving, it's going to impact the data. So all you have to do is pay attention to the data. It's going to lead you in the right direction. And when it comes to news headlines, those are typically short-term, you know, whiplashes or short-term shocks to market prices that are almost always a fade. So, and we talked about it before, but if someone comes out with a press release, a quote, a statement, whatever, those are all highly orchestrated, and they're orchestrated to move, whether it's markets, whether it's market prices, or to, in the geopolitical world, to accomplish some sort of an end. So all of those are orchestrated. And if you're a market participant, you got to understand that and understand that, okay, there's no, it's not a surprise that, okay, we have this bearish headline coming out and it's moving prices down. That's not something that you want to turn bearish on. In fact, I've said almost probably 90% of the time these market headline movers are fades. So you get a negative shock, then you want to be buying. If you get a positive quote, a positive statement, a positive headline come across the wire, then you want to be selling into that. Because like I said, it's all orchestrated. And those short-term blips, you want to basically fade those moves every time. But in the longer term, anything that is worthy of moving the markets or having an impact on the markets, it is going to eventually leak down into the data. So you don't have to pay attention necessarily to the events themselves, but how it impacts the data. And in terms of gold and precious metals, we've said it, we've talked about it a lot in the past, but our thought on precious metals, looking at gold in particular, is that the run up to the 2020 high was basically a test of that highs from back in 2011. Since then, we've basically been consolidating, working off that bull run that we saw to 2020, and I in our view is setting up the next up leg in the bull market. So eventually we work off those excesses that were built up a couple years ago. We're able to break out and put in a sustainable new up leg. How far it goes, I'm not sure, but at this point we've just been working off those excesses, consolidating. I think over the last week or so we've seen some probably key technical developments in terms of breaking out of that, you know, kind of consolidation, kind of that pennant that we've been in. We still have a number of technical challenges ahead in the short to intermediate term, but we've broken through a bunch of those. So we're chipping away at it, I think. Not necessarily time to take off to the upside necessarily in the precious metals complex, but chipping away at some of that resistance. And the more layers we chip away at, the easier it will be to sustain a breakout and a new up leg.
Yeah, solid point there, Dana, that it's encouraging to see this move up, whatever the reasons are. And I, as you pointed out, there's probably too many reasons for people to even factor in how gold is moving. It's not just a war premium. There's also Fed rate hikes. There's the dollar currency relation. There's the weakness in the general markets. But it is encouraging to see the precious metals at least moving higher, but still some work to do with overhead resistance levels to take out. But speaking of the markets, you have pointed out really for a while here, you were expecting some weakness in the markets way before all the headlines started popping out over the last week or two. And you've been spot on, Dana. So when you look at the markets now, are you seeing it a similar situation where you're waiting to see if we get a bottom and a bounce here? Or are you still expecting another potential leg lower to this move that we've already seen to the downside of the general markets?
Waiting to see the next leg down, whatever form it takes, whether it's a retest of those late January lows or maybe even a new leg lower. So we hit that, like we talked about last time I was on, formed a good capitulatory low in initial capitulatory low at the end of January. Saw some good bearish sentiment, some good washout type breath readings for a good low at the end of January. Got that retracement bounce that we were looking for. Initially, the large caps last time we talked were hitting resistance. Those resistance levels that we were looking for a couple weeks ago. The small and broader market had some room to go. They finally got there as well about a week ago. Since then, the risk has been extremely skewed to the downside, and I think it still is right now. We've pulled back quite a bit from those highs a week ago, but I think the still in the near term, the risk is substantial that either we see, you know, a test of those lows from late January or possibly even a new leg down. And if you're looking at some of the growth areas, the NASDAQ, for example, technology, for example, I think those are setting up for further legs down where we saw in the broader market and some of the small cap issues, we saw them hold right at some good support levels, some Fibonacci retracement levels from either whether it's 2020 or even 2009 in some cases. A lot of the growth names in the NASDAQ 100 and technology sectors actually broke down and have been consolidating below those initial FIB levels. And they, in our view, setting up another leg down to potentially another another lower low to that next level of key FIB levels. So depends what market you're looking at, but either way, we're looking at probably a retest of the lows or even another leg down again in those in the NASDAQ tech type sectors.
Yeah, what was so interesting to me about that NASDAQ correction is that the NASDAQ is down about 13% right now, but it bounced right when it got to almost a 20% correction. But your outlook for still lower prices for NASDAQ, can we carry this over into the broad markets and some of the calls that we're hearing of an upcoming recession, tying again into what Chad's point is that we do have upcoming rate hikes and growth has been slowing a little bit. So the argument being the Fed is going to hike us into a recession and a recession pulls down all markets. How concerned do investors need to be that a recession could be around the corner?
You know, that's not our wheelhouse, the fundamental analysis, economic analysis. Again, I would say focus on the market data and whatever is market worthy or market impactful, it will feed into the data. So whether it's you're talking about inflation, recessionary fears, Fed rate hikes, whatever it is, it'll feed into the data. And whatever it is right now, over the last several months at least, has been feeding into a negative outlook, obviously, for markets. And there's nothing, I would say, to your point of continuing fears, whether it's from rate hikes or recession or whatever, or possibly both. I think there's nothing on our radar, nothing in the evidence that we're looking at that would suggest that a low is imminent or a new return, a reversal and a new return to the highs is imminent. In fact, most things are still pointing down in our models. So there is significant risk still here in the near to intermediate term. I think the best thing that what bulls can hopefully hang their hat on is that those capitulatory readings that we saw at the end of January do indeed stick and are the basis for at least a good short-term low that maybe we retest and bounce off there more substantially. But absent that, I don't see any evidence yet, some sort of turnaround, some sort of more optimistic viewpoint right now from the standpoint of the indicators that we look at. And a lot of that has to do with the market internals and breadth and that type of thing. So from that standpoint, if it's a recession, if it's related to Fed hike, whatever, I would say there's still considerable risk right now. So I would be continue to, if talking about managing your accounts, I would continue to actively hedge, actively manage those hedges and keep exposure pretty low right now.
Dana, I love how unemotional you are and unattached to the news and that you do use quantitative models to smooth out all the noise. It's really a breath of fresh air in many sectors. So I've got to ask you about one more that's full of noise, full of opinions, but I'd love to get your practical approach on it. And that's the energy sector. I'd love to know when you look at oil or maybe even the oil ETFs with the stocks, what are you seeing there? Are we getting near a top here or is there more room to run?
I think we're getting extended. Obviously, that's one area. Even the energy stocks that have held up very well, one of the few sectors holding up well, along with financials, not quite as well, but some of the value plays. But energy certainly has been the place to be in terms of the equity market. I think a couple of the ETFs that we look at, especially the XLE, getting close to some longer-term resistance. So I would not be, certainly would not be too aggressive there. Wait, obviously, for some pullbacks to buy there. But in terms of the trend is certainly higher. Crude oil itself, the trend is certainly higher. Commodity markets in general, the trend is still up. So until that changes, I think the game plan is the same. Continue to buy the dips. But like I said, in terms of energy stocks, the trend is up. That's where the relative strength is. But we are starting to approach some key longer term resistance type metrics that we're looking at that might not stop the entire bull market, but might slow things down for a bit.
Dana, before I get you out of here, I know that the Lion Share, the site that I mentioned where people can follow along with your market commentary, you guys are having a five-year sale. Please take us through the details.
Yeah, it's actually a five-year anniversary sale. We launched 5 years ago, and then we are having, we had a special pricing when we launched, then knocked off a third of the price. So we're having a sale right now in commemoration of that, and anyone signs up for an annual membership right now will get a third of the price knocked off. And for those not familiar with it, it's basically an all-access look into how we actually manage money. So we take you through the charts and outlooks every morning on what we're looking at, and actually send out notifications on actual moves that we're making in our portfolio, you know, buys, sells, shorts, and everything. So for those interested, I would say now is a good, a perfect time to try it out, with, given the not only the discount on the site right now, but also the volatility in the market. A lot's going on. We are trading like crazy right now, but it's a good time to check out the site. So thanks a lot.
All right, Dana, we'll wrap it up here. Always interesting hearing and chatting with you and listening to where you see opportunities and what the data is showing you, because, yeah, there is a lot of noise out there and a lot of sensationalized comments that we get from both sides. And the fact of the matter is, we are simply, I guess, just watching the data and seeing where the markets move, because these sensationalized calls, unfortunately, they are always around and they don't usually pan out. Dana, great chatting with you as always, buddy. We'll chat again in another couple of weeks. I appreciate you taking time on this weekend show, and I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Sounds great. Always a pleasure, guys.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're actually going to replay a segment that was posted on Friday featuring Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. Mike does a great job of really just summarizing where we stand for markets and some of the key trends he is watching. I hope you all enjoy this interview, and for everybody listening on the radio, you can hear the full interview on our website, kereport.com. I hope you all have a great weekend. Hey everyone, we're chatting with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. You can also follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Now, Mike, a theme that we've been talking about even at the tail end of last year was this rotation out of growth and tech stocks, and quite frankly, that rotation is continuing, and we are seeing growth in tech stocks continue to get hit. Now, I know that they did rebound a few weeks ago from some of their bottoms, but the rebound that we've seen has actually been quite weak, and it really does just go to the whole narrative of investors are switching course, and as much as people are distracted by geopolitical fears right now, I think more people are switching course because of the fact that the Fed is going to be starting to hike rates. And quite frankly, we have quite a different monetary policy than we did even 6 months ago, let alone a year ago. Mike, take us through your outlook for the growth stocks and tech stocks that, as I mentioned, continue to get hit.
Yeah, I mean, I try and look at the market and sort of where I want to be and where I want to tell subscribers to be and so on, based on where we are in the interest rate credit cycle, economic cycles and so on. So, you know, there's a time and a price to own all kinds of assets. I mean, there's a time when gold works the best. There's a time when tech stocks works the best. There's a time when financials work the best and so on and so forth. If you don't recognize those shifts, when when the interest rate environment changes, the sort of easy money becomes a little more tight environment changes, and you don't adapt to that, that's when you can lose or lose an enormous amount of money. Whereas if you recognize those shifts and you start changing what you're investing in, you can make a lot of money or outperform quite a bit. And what we've really seen in the last several months is starting at the periphery, and it reminds me so much of what I saw both firsthand working at a.com and also just in my investing and analysis career. You're seeing very much what started happening in the second half of 1999 and then spilled over into 2000 and the bear market that came there. And what by that I mean, if you look at some of the peripheral pie in the sky, no profit tech companies, EVs, all the stuff that got way overhyped, a lot of the really peripheral worst of the bunch companies didn't just start falling now. They've been in free fall for months. They started, rolling over as far back as the middle of last year. It's only now that when some of the big names, the Facebooks of the world, or the Netflixes start getting hit, that more of your mainstream tech investors are starting to see the pain as well. But it's an enormous rotation kind of out of that ultra growth, no profit, 10 years down the road, maybe we'll make some money kind of business plan thinking, those kinds of companies, into value sectors, companies that pay dividends, more cyclical and commodity-based names, and even more recently, precious metals. So, if you look, for example, and again, Bitcoin is sort of a different asset class, but it tends to trade along with tech. And if you look at a comparison between, the main Bitcoin ETF, GBTC, and the GLD gold ETF, just to keep things simple. I mean, just recently this week, in a single day, Bitcoin was down 8% and gold was up more than 1%. So that's 9 percentage points divergence in one day. But it's not just a one-day thing. I mean, the last 90 days, Bitcoin is down 30% while gold's up about 1%. In the last year, Bitcoin is down about 20% while gold's up almost 6%. So again, you can see it in terms of the rotations in say crypto into gold. You can see it in the rotation for some of these Cathie Wood ARK innovation type stocks into more boring type sectors and dividend payers and value stocks. But no matter how you slice it, this trend really started in the second half of last year. It's accelerated dramatically in 2022 because, as you mentioned, investors know the Fed is going to have to get on the warpath here with inflation doing what it's doing and all the political pressure building from the Biden administration to just do something about these dismal numbers. And in that environment, the absolute last thing you want to own is all this no profit pie in the sky junk. They're the wrong stocks at the wrong point in the cycle and the wrong prices. Whereas a lot of the more value names are the right stocks at the right prices and the right point in the cycle.
Yeah, Mike, you really laid it out well there. And it's interesting how many people are, because of recency bias, chalking this all up to just some of the latest geopolitical news, when in fact, these trends have been in motion for a while. And when everything was overvalued and at nosebleed levels last year, I remember you and others pointing out just how overvalued some of these sectors were, especially the growth sector and some of the secondary and tertiary tech stocks that had really ratcheted to all-time highs. But now that we see the inflation picture and the CPI reading coming in at 7.5%, and the Fed rate hiking cycle right around the corner in March, there has been a big rotation really over the last few months out of growth and into value. Do you think that's another reason why gold has been starting to outperform even things like Bitcoin, as you lined out, or even outperforming the general markets? Is because people sense there's weakness on the surface in the general markets and they're looking for that safe haven bid?
Sure. In the last couple of weeks with what's happening in Eastern Europe, the Russia-Putin situation, of course, that's sort of adding an extra leg up to gold. But the funny thing is, while gold underperformed, say, the S&P last year, it hadn't, even on its pullbacks, it hasn't made a new low going all the way back to March of last year. So every single pullback has been a little bit shallower than the previous one for 11 months now. It hasn't broken out to the upside until very recently this week. It's kind of testing that $1,900 an ounce level. If it continues to rally in the face of sort of testing some of these key levels and in the face of this rotation, then I think it's got a lot of potential upside and a potential to really flip the script versus last year where it was the underperformer. Now I think gold could be a dramatic outperformer. So it's definitely worth watching. Some very interesting action there. And it does just sort of play into the rotation of people that are sitting on big winnings that are turning into losers, and they're trying to figure out what's going to be the next thing. They're looking for stuff that's underperformed. They're looking for stuff that's not overvalued. And I think in the particular case of gold, one of the big things holding it back was fear that the Fed wouldn't just have to hike rates, but just go on a complete rampage that drives the 10-year to 10% and Armageddon type rate scenario and so on. But if you look at the interest rate curve, the forward yield curve and the forward interest rate markets, they're saying the Fed's going to have to do a lot at the front end, but then the economy is going to be, you know, potentially in bad shape from the impact of all that on future growth and so on. So long-term interest rates, basically, if you take like a 30-year bond, are basically unchanged for months and months and months and months. And a lot of the sort of, again, the forward interest rate futures markets are basically saying that the Fed's going to have to pause this thing somewhere around 2% just because the economy can't handle much more than that. So we'll see what happens there. But I think, again, it's part of that sort of great, you know, everybody talks about the great resignation, everybody quitting their jobs because or during what's happened with COVID and so on, and labor's had the upper hand. I'd say there's also a great rotation going on in a lot of asset classes and a lot of markets. And I don't think it ends, you know, after a month or two or three of a changing of the guard. I think it's going to be something that's with us throughout the year and probably lingering into next year too, depending on how things go.
Mike, have you been paying any attention to some of the recent financial reports out of the major miners? Because it has been interesting. Good reports have been bought. Bad reports have been sold off. So it does show some people are paying attention. Volumes still have generally been low, but any assessment driving underneath the gold price to the gold stocks?
You know, you still have issues with inflation pressures on everything from fuel to labor costs and so on. I mean, miners face some of those same challenges that the manufacturers and other heavy industry type companies do. But I think, again, when you have that tailwind from the price of your commodity or your precious metal that you're producing, that really sort of cures all kinds of ills on the cost front. So I think that, you know, these companies, again, if you see that true money start to rotate and look for havens that aren't overvalued, that haven't, you know, been running for months on end and, you know, look super expensive, or in the case of some of these tech companies are just losing people money hand over fist and they're looking for someplace to go, I think that those names could do pretty well. So again, I think that this is going to be a real sort of script flipping year for us, where after a year of, you know, or months on end, kind of, you know, gold is sort of an asset that you sort of poke with a stick and hope that it, you know, it moves, but it doesn't really do much, like that meme you've probably seen. I think that's going to be a different situation now. It clearly has been in the last month or so. And again, you know, could we see a pullback if for some reason Russia says, okay, you know, let's all make friends and figure a way out of this? Sure, you're going to see gold prices pull back. But I don't think that they're going to go anywhere back to their sort of prior range. I think that there's other reasons to think, you know, there's a lasting, more broad sort of trend going on here that can really give some upside to gold and to mining shares this year.
Well, Mike, one other sector I'd love to get your thoughts on as it relates to gold, and that is the bond market. Because for a long time, traditional wisdom for the last 40 years has been that bonds are a safe haven and you can go to them in times of worry. But right now, if the 10-year is paying a little over 2% and inflation's running over 7%, that's a pretty crappy bet for most people to make. And the Fed has just started to wrap up their tapering program where they were spending up to $120 billion every month on bonds. And now they're not going to be in there buying them. And so there's a lot of larger pension funds or big institutions that are maybe forced to be in them. But for people looking for that safe haven bid, could there be money that flows out of the bond market and into the gold market as a better way to play this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You point out the dilemma there with anybody invested in bonds, given what not just recent inflation has been, but current inflation and sort of the outlook for future inflation for a while now. There's a lot of this is not obviously transitory. That was a bunch of bull, and it's going to be with us for a while. So yeah, I mean, when you look at the real interest rate situation, even with some Fed hikes, unless you think that we're going to see sort of the Jerome Powell be the second coming of Paul Volcker, which I certainly don't think is realistic in any way, shape, or form, then you have to imagine the Fed's going to be kind of behind the curve. You're not going to have positive real interest rates for God knows how long. And in that situation, then, yeah, I mean, if you have that, if you remove that sort of overhang, you know, who wants to own gold because my Bitcoin's making me so much money and look how much money I'm making these tech stocks. If you lose the sort of hot money that was going into that sector that's maybe looking for something else, plus you still have the benefit of the inflation upside, you have the benefit of negative real interest rates and so on for gold, I think you're going to see that rotation. You're going to see, yes, money looking for not just cheap assets, but also something that maybe looks a little bit better than a 10-year treasury here.
So, Mike, I guess big picture, though, we are seeing this rotation. We're not necessarily seeing a complete exit of money out of the markets. The comment being that we have seen some destruction of capital, but is this all setting up for a bigger picture fall in markets where everything gets pulled down? Or do we have a somewhat balanced market here where there are still opportunities and investors aren't going to get so fearful that everybody runs for the door at the same time?
You know, I wouldn't say tech, the sort of peripheral tech and tech names are getting hit the most, but I am seeing, you know, some pretty broader based pullbacks in other parts of the market, other sectors that are kind of teetering here a little bit. So I would definitely say that sort of the caution flag is out, to use a racing analogy. I've taken some exposure off in the Safe Money report. I've recommended people lighten up a little bit. I'm not selling willy-nilly. I'm in general, when I'm taking some more aggressive stuff off, I'm telling them, hey, buy things like healthcare, some pharmaceuticals, higher yield, more defensive kind of names. The overall level of market exposure I want has definitely been going down a little bit here. I'm not willy-nilly selling, but I am closely watching. Because again, if you go back to that dot-com parallel, it's sort of eerie to me, with the exception of the fact that here the Fed hasn't even started raising rates. Unlike back then, they at least got, you know, a few hundred basis points of rate hikes in before it broke the system. Here, it's just the forward rate markets that have been pricing in, just Fed talk. And you're already seeing the yield curve collapse. You're already seeing some of the stuff that suggests, hey, you know, the Fed can't get anywhere near 4%, 5%, 6%, much less maybe 2 or 3 without breaking the system. So definitely more cautious. I don't think it's one of those run for the hills things yet, unless you own all this junk. I mean, you should have got out of this months and months ago. I hope people listened to us when we said that. You know, that stuff is toxic. A lot of it's going to zero, and I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. But I think there's still, you know, there's still names and sort of defensive, more consumer staples, more dividend payers that you don't have to go sell now, but you want to be cautious and watching, because it could be a situation that sort of tips. So that's sort of where I am, cautiously watching.
Well, Mike, that brings up an interesting point. I know at the Safe Money report that you do cover a lot of the high yield stocks and some of the ways to play the dividends during, you know, that pays you to wait basically as a defensive strategy. But in a situation where there could be a policy error from the Fed or where there could be a market rout, would you still recommend people stick with some of those defensive names that pay a dividend if the underlying stocks could still pull back by 20% or maybe more? Or would you recommend them going more to cash during a time period like that?
I would recommend going more to cash. I mean, we haven't been shy in the past when we think the market's in a really bad place, whether it was sort of the peak of the dot-com bubble or peak of the housing bubble. I mean, you know, we've gone to a situation where we've had enormous amounts of cash versus sort of the average fund and so on. So I wouldn't be, you know, averse to saying, look, get out of, you know, not everything, but a lot more than you've already sold now. Again, I'm not kind of at that point yet. It's more of a rotational sort of approach, I guess, to the markets here. And we certainly own a decent, probably a larger allocation of precious metals than a lot of people. And that certainly helped cushion the blow as well. But, you know, if things do sort of look like they're going to go pear-shaped, then yeah, I have no problem telling people, hey, look, you want to, you know, cut your equity exposure from, you know, 85-ish% or whatever, you know, the exact number is at any given time to 40% or 30%. I mean, you know, we'll do it if I feel like that's the kind of environment we're heading into.
Mike, how long is your time frame in terms of this outlook, this more defensive outlook? I ask because there aren't a lot of people that just want to lock in investments and hold them and ride them a certain direction. But sometimes, market-wise, we have a fund manager on who uses a baseball analogy of that sometimes now is the time to hit singles and maybe doubles, not go for the fences, not try to hit the home runs with your investments. It feels like this is the environment that we are in. But that's why I'm curious as to what your time frame outlook is and what your general strategy in terms of types of returns could be in this very different environment.
You know, a lot of the stuff that I recommend is multi-month, multi-quarter, and in some cases, multi-year time horizons. But, you know, we're not, I mean, as a newsletter, I'm not looking to tell people, you know, just buy Apple and hold it for 10 years. I mean, you know, that's what they can get in any fund, any sort of product that they buy off the shelf or you know, whatever, any environment. And you know, we try to be tactical. If we think there's going to be a real serious downturn, bear market, whatever you want to call it, I mean, and it's going to last a couple of years, or it's going to last a year, and it's going to cost you 30% of your portfolio or whatever. I mean, in the case of the dot-com bust, 80% of your wealth if you had tech stocks. I mean, you know, why just sit in that? If you had mostly tech stocks at the crypto.com bust, you lost 80% of your money and you didn't get back to even for what, 14, 15 years? I mean, who wants to sit through that? Everybody says, oh, look how much Amazon's worth now. But are there many people who, you know, held it when it went from what, $1,000 to $3 or whatever the numbers are? I mean, not many people stuck around for the rebound that ultimately happened. So, you know, we do consider a reasonable amount of timing based on what our models and our analysis is showing and do try to account for that. So that's sort of my approach to it. I mean, I think, you know, just buy and hold forever. Maybe that's good for a portion of your retirement money or something, you know, you have money you just never want to touch and that's fine. But I think, you know, if you're an average investor who also is taking control of a portion of their portfolio to try and do what they can and outperform at times, you know, then buy and hold forever doesn't make sense to me.
All right, that's going to wrap up this weekend's edition of the KE Report. As I mentioned, everybody, please go back on our website, listen to those daily editorials and the company updates that we publish throughout this week. We are trying to just produce the most content we have to help everybody stay ahead and on top of these markets. As always, you can keep in touch with us through email. My email is fleck@kereport.com. Shad's email is shad@kereport.com. We love hearing from each and every one of you, and well, we hope you join us throughout the week next week as we undoubtedly will continue to see some pretty crazy market moves all heading into that Fed rate hike. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.